podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. The show originally aired on the Premier Network's 200 stations all over the country on Sunday, August 2nd, 2020. This is episode 1716. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you from TWiT's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check it out at lastpass.com/twit. This episode of The Tech Guy brought to you by LastPass. Allow your remote workforce the ability to do their best work without jumping through hoops to ensure your business security. With LastPass, yeah. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Yeah, time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, all that jazz. 8888, ask Leo, the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. 888-827-5536. Give me a ring and we'll talk about tech together. There is a website where I put everything. Actually, I don't do anything. James DeRuvo, our scribe, puts everything that happens on the show there, including links to websites and your answers and your questions and all that stuff. That's techguylabs.com. It's free. I mention it not because I make any money on it. In fact, it costs me money, but it's free. Because you need somewhere to go. You don't have time to write this stuff down. You got to just be able to go to the website and get it. So all you have to remember is techguylabs.com. There's a link there to the chat room, to the phone number, all the answers, even audio and video of the show after the fact. This morning, what did I do? I downloaded and installed TikTok and then spent a wasted hour, but a very enjoyable hour, scrolling through the memes. I've used TikTok before. I've even posted stuff on TikTok. I think our social media team, hey, Jerry Masako, I think our social media team even uses TikTok from time to time. But I just thought, you know, maybe it's a good time now to download it, put it on the phone in case it gets banned. Talk about confused. Yeah, I thought I'd send all my information to China. Have it, China. Enjoy it. Why not? I'm already sent it to Google and Facebook. Might as well give China a look. Look, see, at my boring life. Drive to the studio, drive home. Drive to the studio, drive home. That's it. Don't go anywhere. Don't do anything. If that excites you, President Xi, have at it. Have at it. It's actually a really fun, it's probably the most engaging, fun, creative social site out there. I think it's awesome. Funny stuff. It's just well done. It's just really well done. And of course, the president wants to shut it down. He's sending very mixed signals, though, because it's really unclear, first of all, whether he could. I guess he could. Yeah, he could issue an executive order, and then we'll see in court, because there's no precedent for that. Even Chinese companies have First Amendment rights. TikTok's scared. They've promised now, you know, they do all the things to make the White House happy. 10,000 U.S. jobs. We have a U.S. CEO. And finally, last week, they started negotiating with Microsoft to buy the American part of it. Then the president said, no, I don't want an American company to buy it. I just want to shut it down. Huh? He said that late Friday. So Microsoft said, make up your mind. Meanwhile, TikTok is filling up with memes saying, heck no, we won't go, that kind of thing. I think it's quite enjoyable and completely harmless. Completely harmless. You know, any app you put on your phone, you should know this. You should know this. Your phone is the perfect spy device. It already is. And I don't care. You say, oh, I'm using Apple. I don't care. Apple, Android, it's a perfect spy device. What's the first thing I ask you? You ever see a Jason Bourne movie? You know, the spy movies. You ever see them? They always seem to begin. Jason's driving around. He's cool. I'm cool. I'm Jason Bourne. He's driving around. And then some woman gets in trouble and screaming, help me, help me. And he says, hop in the car. What's the first thing he does before he drives the woman to safety? He takes her phone. He breaks it in half, throws it out the window. Like, that does any good. By the way, just a tip. Doesn't do nothing. They just pick it up, put it back together again. But importantly, it's not the break it in half that matters, although it's quite satisfying, especially in the old days. Those phones with hinges, man, they broke nice. Boom. Show off your muscles, Matt Damon. I'm strong. I can break a phone in half. Throw it out the window. That's the most important thing, because once it's out the window, it's no longer a homing device, a microphone, and a camera in the car. That's what you're carrying around. You're carrying a beautiful little computer that's always connected to the internet, always beaming, beaconing, broadcasting your location. Always. Not just GPS, mind you. The Bluetooth in there. There's something called beacons, Bluetooth beacons. Apple put them in there first, and Android said, we got to have those too. And the whole idea, I don't know if anybody's, I don't think anybody's using them. Whole idea is you go into a Gap, you walk into the Gap store, and the beacon on your iPhone says, hey, Leo's here. He wears XXL. Point him in the right direction. And a little thing pops up that says, hey, welcome to the Gap. 50% off if you turn left now. That was the idea of beaconing. Some museums use them, you know. You're standing in front of the Mona Lisa. Yes, it's small. Very small. Surprisingly small. That's how it was painted. No, it's not a fake. Don't touch it. That kind of thing. So it's doing that with Bluetooth. Here's a fun thing to do. Turn on your Bluetooth pairing. I've done this. Get on the bicycle and ride down the street. By the end of the street, you will have in your Bluetooth a list of hundreds of devices. Joe's speakers, Sally's refrigerator, Tommy's watch, Jerry's iPhone. All of those listed because they're sitting there going, hey, hey, over here, all the time. Then there's the GPS. Oh, and then it's got a microphone on it. Actually, most of the modern phones have more than one. They have many microphones so they can be really, really accurate. To really hear every word you're saying when you try to get Siri to do something. And she goes, I don't know what you're talking about. But boy, she heard you. She heard you loud and clear because you got 18 microphones in that thing. And then there's a camera. In my case, not just one. There's one, two, three, four. Four cameras. Not to mention depth sensing, accelerometers, a compass. This phone is designed to be, and it's incredibly useful because of it, the perfect homing device. That's why Jason Bourne throws it out the window. So we're carrying that around. Now, who has access to all that great information? Everybody. When you put an app on your phone, what's the first thing it says? It says it asks a few things. Can I send you notifications? That's mostly it, right? Can I use location? If it's a map, why not? So you say yes, yes, yes. Now that app is just sitting there. It doesn't ask a lot of the things it does. In fact, it's funny because Apple's about to release in a month or two the next version of their iPhone operating system, iOS 14. And the whole world's up in arms because iOS 14 adds new things, new privacy protections. Like, here's one that the ad industry doesn't like too much. Hey, right when you install the app, hey, is it okay if I use the Apple advertiser ID to identify you? No. You could turn it off, but it's buried way deep in the settings. Now it's asking you, and the advertising industry says, that's going to kill us. Nobody's going to say yes to that. We're out of business. Okay. Apple says, yeah, see, that's what you get. Apple, by the way, don't think Apple's like the angel here because they wanted to do an ad business. They had a thing called iAds that would do exactly that. That's why they had the Apple advertiser ID. It just flopped. So Apple said, oh, no, what are we going to do? Oh, I know. Let's pretend we care about your privacy because we can't track you any, you know, we can't sell it anymore. So we'll make lemonade out of this lemon, and we're the privacy company. But they still, when iOS 14, now apps as I'm typing, it says, I'm checking the clipboard. I'm seeing what you got on the clipboard. I'm seeing what, like every 3 seconds, every time I type a character in a lot of apps, more than 50. Most of the time, by the way, that's meaningless. It's not use. It's not doing. It's just. You're getting bombarded with these privacy messages because it looks good for Apple, but that's still not telling you a lot of the things apps do. The minute you install, look, do you have Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp on your smartphone? Oh, you do? You got the best. Boy, they know what you're doing every moment of the day. So I'm not too worried about President Xi knowing that I'm going out to buy jeans. It's okay. First of all, I ain't doing that. But even if I were, who cares? You know, if you work for the Defense Department, if you're a military contractor, if you're a spy for the NSA or the CIA, you probably shouldn't have TikTok on your phone anyway, right? Among 100 other things, probably you shouldn't even have a smartphone. Give them a dumb phone because everything on there is tracking you like crazy. That's why people make up silly apps like the Break Wind apps. There's no percentage in that for them. You know what they get out of that? There's an app on your phone that now they can track you. Now they can see all the stuff you do, and they can sell that to marketers. Marketers know so much about you already. And nobody's saying anything about that. It's just convenient. Say, oh, those Chinese guys, they're watching us. That's good. That's spooky. I don't know if at this point, it's very confusing what the White House is going to do. Are they going to ban it? They said it could be as soon as Saturday, yesterday. Didn't do it. Why don't you buy it, Microsoft? No, never mind. I don't want anybody to buy it. It's very confusing. So I'm going to put my 2 cents in for freedom. I downloaded it, installed it, and I'm laughing. I'm having fun watching the TikToks. That's it. I'm not scared. Well, I worry a little more about, you know, hacking voting booths. Worry more a little bit more about that. You know, that might be something good to worry about. No, we're not worried about that. Just about TikTok. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Website techguylabs.com. We will go to your calls momentarily. Let's talk high tech, you and me. That's a TV. Last time I did this, National Geographic pulled us off YouTube. Even though, yeah, I love Sarah Cooper. She is awesome. Former Googler. Did you know that? Sarah Cooper. I always want to say Sarah Connor. Sarah Cooper used to be at Google. I like SpaceX because it looks like that's temporary. Like they set up some tables, got some big monitors. That's in Hawthorne. But that's not like if you look at, you know, Houston Space Center, you know, why don't they show the big screens? They don't want us to see it. That guy in the mask, the blue mask in the middle, that's Elon. Somebody said Elon's in the room. Somebody said that guy there, that's Elon. I don't know. Or is that Elon? That looks like Elon's haircut. It's a miracle. She shows up every week. Does not let us get down. She's always keeping us up to beat here with 2 quarts of water today. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the unbreakable Kimmy Schaffer.
One's just ice.
one quart of ice, 1 quart of water. Don't let that spill into that transmitter there. We could be off the air.
Oh, funny.
Hi.
Kim,
we call her the unbreakable Kimmy Schaffer because she's the front line, the first line of defense. When you call this show, that's who you talk to.
Yes, it is.
She prepares you. Are you ready for the, I don't know, re-entry and landing of Doug and Bob McKenzie? the Crew Dragon astronauts? They've been in the space station for 2 months.
I know. It was so exciting when they lifted off. We were watching during the show.
It's the first time, this is my space guy telling me this, he's in my ear, Captain John says, this is the first time in 35 years we've splashed down into water. Because I guess the Soviets, I'm sorry, the Russians, what am I thinking? The Soviets land on land with parachutes, but we like to land in water. Because then you can...
Seems like a softer landing.
Yeah. Well, it probably isn't. Water's hard if you're coming in fast. True. Coming in hot. And so we're watching, right now I'm watching SpaceX.
Watching
apparently
people.
That's Elon Musk there in the middle with the president of SpaceX and Gwen Shotwell there. See, there's Elon.
Okay.
Looks like he's wearing a bulletproof vest. That can't be right. Elon, of course, paid for this. Well, he didn't really. He sort of paid for this. I think the government gave him a little bit. But we'll be watching with interest because we like space. Meanwhile, who should I talk to?
Let's go to line 4, Dave, in Quincy, Illinois.
Thank you, Ms. Sheffa. Hello, Dave. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello. How are you doing? I'm a fellow ham.
Oh. But now, I should say that I'm a ham in one way. Like a bad actor ham, but also ham could stand for amateur radio operator. And I'm also W6.
56 years.
What's your call sign?
AB0LJ.
That's a good one. AB0LJ. Wow. That's nice and short.
Yep.
I'm W6TWT. So good to talk to you. I don't ever get on the air because I spend so much time in front of a microphone in real life. The last thing I want to do. Although, remember Art Bell? He'd do 4 hours of the radio, and they come and do 5 hours of ham.
Uh huh.
Crazy.
Well, I'm a CW guy.
I want to learn CW. How did you learn CW? That's Morse code for you.
I learned it in Boy Scouts, and I just kept up with it.
I love it. There's good ways to learn it now. I want to learn it because I think that'd be fun. So you can just hear it, and you know what it's saying.
Yeah, I'm starting to get a little rusty, but. Yeah, I can do okay.
Sounds fun.
That's the only language I speak, foreign language.
That's a good foreign language. What can I do for you today?
Well, I was listening to the radio. We're listening to your show on Saturday morning, and
the guy called
in, and he said he had a shortwave tube radio for sale that worked, and he wanted $50 for it.
Good deal.
So soon after he got off, I called him, and I said, what kind of radio is it? He said, well, it was my brother's. I don't know. It's just a black box to me. And so I said, well, I'll be right over. And I went over, and I paid him his $50, and it turned out to be a Zenith Transoceanic.
Wow. A classic.
Yeah, and it works.
How fun.
And so I'm in the process of, I got the schematic for it in among the papers, and I found out a way I can make a battery pack for it.
Nice. You can carry it around. It was a portable originally, right?
Yes. It has a handle on it.
Nice. One of the things about shortwave that's fun, you don't need a license because you're just listening.
Yeah.
And it's really fun to kind of, when I was a kid, I would do that all the time. Listening for radio from all over the world. I used to listen to Soviet Union radio all the time. It's fun.
Well, if you subscribe to one of the ham magazines, I won't say which one on the air, but they have a shortwave listening.
I think that's a good way to get into it.
Yeah.
So what's your question? We got about 45 seconds left. That's
my question is, I've got a Chromebook. What kind of, do I have a Windows 10 in it?
No.
Ooh.
Oh, no, no. A Chromebook, the whole idea of a Chromebook is it's not Windows 10. That's kind of like its selling point. It is not Windows 10. It's really just a Chrome browser. If you're curious, under the hood, it's got Linux running, but you don't ever see that. You see what's called Chrome OS. And really all that is the Chrome browser. Very secure, and increasingly, you can do more and more. You can now run Android apps on modern Chromebooks. You can run Linux on modern Chromebooks. And here's the extra little catch. Coming soon, Windows 10 apps, but not yet. But coming soon. Hello there, Sammy.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
Re-entry is apparently either towards the end of or during or right after 11:48, so it's right after your segment.
Okay.
The 5 minutes we'll before that is the fun part because that's
talk
when...
Talk about trailers and then you can switch over to the re-entry.
I'll just... But don't be thrown if I suddenly switch over to... Doesn't this... It's so weird. These are like portable tables. It's like they just...
It's the typical Silicon Valley open office layout.
Yeah, it is. That's Elon in the middle right there.
It's a layout that I've always despised.
This is Elon right there. Yeah, I don't like it. It's hard to work. John says you can see robots in the background. Yeah, that's robots.
It's probably some of those Nightscope security robots or something.
This is where they do assembly.
Or is it the industrial? Is the assembly bots?
I think they do assembly here. So this is in Hawthorne.
Yeah.
Let's press play. I don't want to miss it because I'm taking a still picture. How do I know if it's live? I don't understand this YouTube stuff.
I don't know. Does it say live?
I don't get it how it works. I guess it's live. Quality, auto, high, medium, low. Last time I played this when Bob and Doug were taken off, National Geographic pulled down.
You got taken off. You got taken off too.
So annoying. And they said, whoops, because they don't own this. NASA TV's free for all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we paid for NASA TV. We paid for the rocket. You know, we funded it all with tax dollars.
Tax dollars at work.
Yeah.
Elon gets the glory. We get the bill.
Yep.
There he is. And that's Gina Shotwell, apparently, and the president of SpaceX there. And we're just waiting.
Yeah, Gwynne Shotwell's the one that really runs the day-to-day operations at SpaceX.
Yeah, she's the boss.
That's he needs someone like her at Tesla to, you know, he needs to step
back
Let somebody that knows how to operations manage a manufacturing
person.
Business run that business day to day.
Yeah, exactly right.
He can create the vision, you know, give him the overall direction, and what he needs is his Tim Cook, but he refuses to give up that control over the company.
Yeah. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and as always, this time of the day on the Tech Guy Show, it's time for Sam Abulsamid. He's our car guy. He is an analyst at Guidehouse Insights, principal analyst, and also a podcaster, Wheel Bearings Podcast at wheelbearings.media. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Leo. How are you this week?
I am great. How's things in... Look at you with your... You're what is it, a Tahoe towing a boat?
That's actually a Ford Explorer.
Ford Explorer. You going to the lake?
I want to talk a little.
Do a little water skiing?
No, not today. It's been raining all day today, so no lake today. No lake today.
I'm sorry to see that.
But I wanted to talk a little bit about towing because we got an email to the Wheel Bearings feedback link earlier this week from a tech guy listener. That had some questions about towing, particularly, you know, a couple of SUVs that he was thinking about buying.
Wait a minute. This is a high-tech show. We cover high-tech.
And that's what I'm going to get to.
High-tech towing?
Towing, you'd be surprised. You know, towing, you know, have you ever driven a vehicle towing a trailer?
No, thank God.
It's actually surprisingly challenging.
Yeah, especially backing it down the ramp to put it in the water.
Oh yeah,
very.
And that's
hard.
One of the things I want to talk about today. There's two technologies that have emerged in the last 6 or 7 years that make towing a lot easier. The first one that came out was something called Trailer Sway Control, which debuted back about 2013. I think it was on the Chevy Silverado was the first one that had it, but it's on pretty much all new trucks and SUVs now. You know, if you've ever towed a trailer, one of the things that can happen sometimes is if you get a gust of wind or just if you're going a little bit too fast or the weight shifts in the trailer, it'll start to sway back and forth. And that can get very disconcerting if you're going 60, 70 miles an hour down the highway. And it can be really hard to recover that manually. If you're watching the stream, the video stream, I've got a video playing over my shoulder here that shows you what that
wibble
looks
wobble.
Like.
I've seen that wibble wobble with the trailer many times.
Yeah.
Not good.
So what trailer? what trailer sway control does. And this, like I said, this is on all new trucks and SUVs that can tow, is they use the stability control system. You know, so it has the sensors, got a yaw rate sensor, detects when you're when the vehicle is starting to sway back and forth, because it's got this basically a pendulum hanging off the back of it.
Yeah.
And then it gets
oscillating and resonating, and pretty soon you're out of control.
Exactly. So what it does is, when it detects that happening, when you've got a trailer behind you, it will actually start to apply the brakes on one side of the vehicle and the other individually to slow it down, and also back off the engine torque a little bit to slow the vehicle down, and do that in a controlled way until it gets back under control again. And it basically recovers all by itself, which is really nice to have.
When you're driving that? Does it feel like it's taking control?
It just feels like it's settling itself
more
down
stable. Yeah.
All by itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's stabilizing it by itself, which is what they try to do. They try to make it as seamless as possible.
Yeah. You know, it's really amazing. That's what's so cool about all this computer technology in your car. Things like anti-lock brakes, which you know, when they first came out, you kind of wouldn't feel it pulsing and stuff. Now it's just like smooth. It's butter.
Yep. That's
really
exactly
cool.
What they try to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then the other one that has come out a few years ago, it's I think right now Ford is the only one that has this, but I'm pretty sure other companies are working on it. It's something they call Pro Trailer Backup Assist. And, you know, using the technology that you already have on the vehicle for other stuff, in this case, using the rear backup camera and using the electric power steering, the same feature that you have. Oh, somebody else is trying to call me on Skype. The other
<You're> popular,
the power steering that you use for your active park assist, like you experienced when you were at Ford back in 2010.
Yes, experience is one word for it.
Yeah, we're using that in combination, so that what you can do is, when you enable the backup assist, it actually shows you the view from the backup camera. So you watch the trailer.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, if you're trying to back up a trailer, it can be really hard to maneuver.
Oh, it's so
hard.
Instead of, because it's almost counterintuitive, because you turn one way, it goes the other way. It's kind of like,
exactly,
what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you do is, you actually just watch the view on the center screen and just turn the knob in the direction where you want the trailer to go.
What?
And then the steering does it automatically.
That's
for
so
you.
Cool. That's so cool. It works?
Yes. And you know, you can just back right up onto, you know, down the boat ramp, you know, nice and smoothly. It's really easy. I've tried this. It works really well. And then when you're ready to get out, you know, pull the boat out, you can, you know, go back the other way. It works fantastic. So it's, you know, using some of the really cool technology that we've already got in these vehicles in new ways.
I'm always impressed when I see drivers of 18-wheelers, and we have a big beer company next door in Lagunitas, and I watched them come with the hops and the mash and these big double trailers, and watching them back in, I'm always blown away at how good they are. They don't need it because they're highly trained and they know what they're doing. But if you're a Sunday boater, you look at it and you go, how do they do that? That's a great idea.
I mean, a lot of people, I know here in Michigan, a lot of people have boats that, you know, they put away for the winter time. You know, they take them out in the spring. They'll take, you know, tow it to the lake in the springtime, put it in the water, leave it in the water all summer, and then in the fall they take it out and put it back in storage again. And, you know, so you're only doing this a couple of times a year, so you don't get a whole lot of practice with it, you know,
right,
for a lot of people.
Right.
And, you know, it's something that can be, you know, if you don't do it right, can be quite dangerous. So, you know, having these electronic assist systems that can help you out and make it easier, is great for safety. It's great for convenience. You know, and, you know, now, you know, as we're starting to get, you know, into, you know, a lot more SUVs out there, you know, a lot of people are doing things like towing trailers, towing boats, mm-hmm, jet skis, mm-hmm, snowmobiles.
I'll be towing, I'll be towing jet skis as soon as we retire. That's Lisa's told me. Yep, you're going to be towing. You're going to the lake. Where you're going to be towing the jet skis. Okay, yes, dear. So I guess I better get one of these vehicles. This is, to me, forget, you know, the self-driving cars that everybody talks about. This is really useful. The auto park, the auto, you know, reverse with a trailer. the eliminating fishtailing. These are really practical uses of this kind of technology.
Yeah, and it really is, especially the trailer sway control is a real safety boon.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference. And, you know, other, you know, vehicles also, you know, are using the same kind of idea in other ways as well. I mean, one of the other things that you have on a lot of modern cars is crosswind assist. You know, a lot of, if you're driving down the highway and there's a strong crosswind, you know, there are quite a few cars now that will, again, using that electric power steering, automatically adjust for that. You know, if it feels that the car is pulling to one side, even though you're trying to go straight, it'll automatically steer the wheels a little bit keep you going straight under those conditions.
Yeah.
So
assist is the word. I like assist.
Yeah, and that's the key. It's helping you out. It's coming in and, you know, it's like a big hand, you know, giving you a little push, a little shove, you know, to keep you where you intend to go. The idea is the systems are trying to detect what you want to do and trying to make sure the vehicle does what you're looking to do, as opposed to trying to decide, you know, what it should be doing.
Honestly, in general, in computer technology, when we try to make computers duplicate human effort, they fail miserably. When we have them help us, because there's things we humans do so well automatically the computers just can't do, but they can help us. And that's a really nice kind of partnership. That's a better way
to go. That idea of a guardian or a co-pilot, I think, is a great way to look at it.
Sam Abul Samad, he's our car guy, principal researcher at Guidehouse Insights. And if you love this stuff, you will love his Wheel Bearings podcast. You can find it everywhere you find your podcasts or go to their website, wheelbearings.media. Safe driving, Sam. We'll talk next week.
See ya.
Perfect. Perfect, perfect, perfect. That's cool. Neat stuff.
Yeah.
Boy, I love that backing up
it's
thing.
Stuff, it's stuff you don't think about, you know, things like trucks necessarily being that high tech, but they're actually using a lot of cool technology in there.
So maybe what we'll do when Lisa's ready to get her new car is get an electric F-150 or something like that.
Yeah, electric F-150 or maybe one of the Rivians. Rivian's going to be coming out next year.
I'm very nervous about – I want to get cars from car companies.
What's different about Rivian is they've actually hired a lot of engineers, you know, from the auto industry. So they actually have a lot of – in fact, you know, I know somebody who's working with them. He actually retired a couple years ago from Ford. From manufacturing engineering, from body engineering, and he's been consulting with them for the past couple of years. They've hired a lot of other really smart people, and you know they are also working with Ford. Ford is an investor in Rivian, so they've been helping them out as well. But yeah, I mean you know Ford, there's the electric F-150. GM's going to have the Hummer EV pickup truck next summer, so maybe that's another option for you. Hey, that one's got 1,000 horsepower.
Wow. I don't know if I need that. But I guess I always wanted an Airstream. So if I got an Airstream, there you go.
Yeah. You know, you can give that one to Lisa. She, you know, she won't mind it.
She will love it. Are you kidding? Yeah.
I mean, that's the top end model. You'll be able to get lower power versions too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll be calling you before we do anything.
Always happy to help.
Thank you, Sam.
All right.
Have a great day. Weekend. Take care.
Talk to you next week.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Once again, Elon Musk and SpaceX putting on a show as the Crew Dragon comes in. Four drogue shoots out. It's just a few kilometers above water. It's the first splashdown landing of a American space vehicle in 35 years. And, of course, there's a special SpaceX boat that's going to pick it up. I presume the picture we're getting, if you're watching on NASA TV or SpaceX TV on YouTube, you can see the actual video picture of it. I presume that's coming from the boat, which means it's pretty close in. 45 years, they said, 45 years since we've had a splash landing like this. There's the shot. It's floating in. 8888 Ask Leo. I know, we talk high tech, But there is very little better expression of what American innovation and high tech can do than the space program. And it's just remarkable. It's just beautiful. Doug and Bob coming home. They're almost home, floating in, nice and slow. I can't take my eyes away, but let's get another call in. Jonathan, Scottsdale, Arizona, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Leo. Love your show. I'm actually watching the space landing as well.
Oh, look at that. It's amazing. They're just bobbing in the ocean, just came down.
There goes the water.
Yep, there goes the little rescue vehicle. The parachutes are floating down.
It is. I got my 9-year-old son watching, too. It's probably his first time seeing this.
It's pretty exciting. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I grew up watching this. I was his age almost exactly when we walked on the moon. So it's nice that another generation gets to experience this.
It sure is. It sure is. Well, anyways, I'll go to my question. So I've been trying to make my home a little smarter, and I picked up a couple of Philips Smart Wi-Fi LED bulbs.
Yeah.
And I hooked them into my Google Home speaker, and it was great. I could control them with my voice, you know, turn the lights on and off. And then lo and behold, one night I tried to turn them on with my voice, and the speaker replied back that my lights are unavailable.
Ay, ay, ay.
That's something you want to have happen when you want the lights to turn on, and it says, sorry, they're unavailable. And so I'm just, I guess I'm not, and I don't think it's my Wi-Fi connection.
No.
All my other devices are fine. So I don't know if I just have some cheap bulbs, if I need like the more expensive ones.
No, the Philips ones are very good.
Well, they're not the Philips Hue. I won't clarify. They're the Philips that work through the Wiz Connected app. And
yes.
I think it's a Home Depot exclusive. So
yeah.
I'm not sure.
But they're still the Hues. They just have different technology. The advantage these have, you don't need a hub, which you do need with the Hue. But I think Philips very good. I mean, they've been doing this a long time. This is really the problem with smart homes in general. They are finicky. They take a lot of attention, and sometimes they stop working. And you're right, it's kind of annoying. Now, this is why anybody with a smart home smartens up and always has a physical switch for those lights, right? And you don't ever take that out. It's just so probably what you need to do is go through the initial pairing process that you went through with the Wiz app in the first place. Pretend that you just got these bulbs.
Okay.
It's so annoying. It's not at all unusual. I honestly was all in on this stuff a few years ago, and I got all the Nest thermostat and the Hue lights and all that stuff. And slowly, bit by bit, they become more and more, you know, disconnected, little used. They're a gimmick, I think. They're a gimmick.
These are definitely fun. I know they have like the LifeX ones, which are probably around $60 a bulb. So I didn't know if
because I have given up on this, I'm not an expert anymore, but I think my colleague Stacey Higginbotham, who does IoT, specializes it, and my friend Micah Sargent and Matthew Casanelli, who do our Smart Tech Today show, both like the LifeX a lot.
Okay.
So, but honestly, these are from Philips, so it's not like you got cheap, you know, no name bulbs. You got decent bulbs. I just think that this is the nature of Wi-Fi, and it might be that you'll get a better result. In fact, I know you'll get a better result if you get a device that actually has a hub. Because what happens with the hub is, instead of trying to use Wi-Fi, which is not designed for this and is, you know, can drop, and then the bulb gets confused and doesn't know what to do, the hub has its own backbone connection to the light bulbs, and then it's connected to your network via Wi-Fi, and that tends to be more, I think, more reliable, because it's using Zigbee or Z-Wave or one of the protocols that's designed for IoT devices. I think it's a guess, but I think that's where they went wrong with these smart Wi-Fi LEDs, is that they don't have a hub. They just, you know, you're connecting individually via Wi-Fi to each bulb. There's also a security issue with that, because they have Wi-Fi. They can be, if there's a flaw, and there has been in the past with these bulbs, which they fixed, but if there's a flaw with it, they can be a gateway into your home network. Somebody would have to be sitting out on your curb. It's not something you got to really be scared about. But that's another drawback to making the bulbs too smart. You want them kind of semi-smart.
Okay. I wasn't sure if the hub was better, having some type of bridge, but I figured if the Wi-Fi, does that connect to the Wi-Fi as well? Because I was thinking if the Wi-Fi goes down or something.
No, it does. But you could Ethernet it. I'm pretty sure the hub has an Ethernet connection. Check and see. But I think my hub is connected via Ethernet. So it isn't Wi-Fi at all.
Okay.
That doesn't mean it's more secure because, but see, the bulbs are dumber, so they're less of a gateway. I think these Wi-Fi bulbs, because they are Wi-Fi connected, each bulb is an Internet of Things device all by itself.
Okay.
And you see, and one other problem you'd have is maybe some bulbs work and some don't. It's just not, it's not fun.
Okay. Well, I might try the LifeX. And if that happens again, I might actually try one with the hub. And if not, I'll probably just pull them out and put some standard old
lights. You know, the light switch has worked very well since electricity first became common in the home about 100 some years ago. And I think there's no reason really to change it. It's not that much more convenient. I like the idea of bulbs knowing it's sunset and coming on and maybe changing color over time. I like the idea of it. But if it worked reliably, but it's just too much fussing and fighting and feuding with these things. It's just not worth it. Somebody in the chat room saying they just got the the EcoSmart. They use Zigbee, and as the Maddox says, that's really good. He really likes those. So I think it's part of the problem. Is, you know, just IoT is just, it's not there yet, I think. I think that's just the issue. I've been, you know, we've been hoping for this for so long. It's been years we've been talking about the smart home and all that stuff. It's just dumb. Just dumb. So the Zodiac went out to the astronauts. We still have a picture of the capsule floating nicely in the ocean. John, is that Pacific, Atlantic? Where did the capsule come down? Right off the Florida coast in the Atlantic. In the Gulf. Okay. They've gotten very good at these pinpoint landings. Now, a couple of Zodiacs on the way. The astronauts, I'm sure, will be recovered soon. So it looks like they're home safe. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches. Actually, digital photography will be the topic in about half an hour when our photo guy, Chris Marquardt, stops by. Meanwhile, let's keep the calls going from Bowling Green, Florida. Roger's on the line. Hello, Roger.
Well, hello, Leo. Greetings from wet and windy Florida.
Yeah, you're on the hurricane side, I guess.
Actually, no. We're closer to Tampa, so
that's good.
We're not getting much of anything over here. A few little stray showers from the outer bands and gentle breezes. Our local ham radio Aries group, though, has activated the net in standby mode just in case there's like a tornado or something you sometimes get spun up when you get the oncoming bands onto the peninsula.
Yeah. That's one of the things we were talking earlier about, amateur radio Aries, which is the amateur radio emergency services, is one of a number of things hams do that are so great in times of natural disaster. They're really great. Are you an Aries member?
Oh, yes. Many, many years. Nice. Aries and Races.
Nice. Races is another group. That's really, especially in your area, that's a huge help. Often when the lines are down, the power's out, the one way you can communicate is via ham radio. And amateur radio operators really step up when those. In fact, you guys train for this all year long, I know.
That's why we're treating this as a training exercise.
Yeah, that's right.
Even
yeah.
though there's nothing going on, we don't expect anything, this provides good training.
Good on you. That's great. So what can I do for you today?
Well, I have been thinking about this for quite some time, and lately there's been quite a bit of publicity about flaws in consumer-grade routers that are unpatched, and the one that I had been using for several years, they haven't updated the firmware in that for about 3 years. So I've decided to build my own, something with more capabilities. So what I'm going to do is I've got a mini PC with 4 Ethernet ports, and I've got a switch and couple of, actually three Ubiquiti access points for the Wi-Fi, and I'm going to build my own router. I'm thinking at this point of pfSense, but perhaps something along OpenSense or one of the other firewall operating systems. Long-time Linux guy, so the Nixes don't bother me. I'm just not familiar with this aspect of it, and I know you have talked about it in the past about your house, how you have set up multiple subnets for IoT, and that's one of the things that I wanted to do. So two questions, actually, is do you have a preference on what operating system is the best one to use? And second, how would you configure the LAN, considering the fact that we've got four ports, one for the wide area network, one for the main, one for IoT, and one for the guest network?
This is something I've wanted to do for some time. You probably listened to, if not, you should listen to our Security Now podcast with Steve Gibson, because he talks about this a lot. He's really great on this subject. He runs pfSense, likes it. In fact, he does, it's too, not too late, but you've gone another route. He, instead of using an old PC lying around, I'm sure he has a few of those, actually has a little appliance that he buys from a company called NetGate, the SG1100, that runs pfSense. So it's a little, you know, ARM processor, almost an IoT device, but it's got all the features that you need to run a pfSense. He likes pfSense a lot. It's open source. And I don't have any strong opinion about other versions of pfSense, but I think pfSense is kind of the way to go. And as for segmenting your LAN, you can, I'm sure, do that very easily with pfSense. You may have to put extra Ethernet cards in that box so that you can have them. You have different Ethernet connectors, but I don't think that's going to be a problem at all. I know Steve does that with pfSense, so that's going to be a simple thing to do. It's actually a really good idea because you'll keep it up to date, and pfSense is a much more, I think, much more secure and certainly much more powerful solution for doing your own routing. I've been meaning to do this exact thing. In fact, I wanted to get the NetGate box, but as many of us geeks have PCs lying around that we could use for this kind of thing. I guess you could even probably use a Raspberry Pi or something like that, but you've got something more powerful, which means you'll get more throughput that way.
Well, the box that I'm going to be using has got an i3 in it, 8 gigs of RAM and a small solid-state drive.
Plenty. I mean, and these guys are running, you know, a ARM Cortex chip in it. It's much, much slower than your i3, so you're in good shape, yeah. How many Ethernet ports on the back of that?
It's got four ports,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that means I think you could do, you're going to use one to connect to your cable modem or your DSL modem or whatever you're using to convert your internet into Ethernet. So that'll use one. And the other three you could use for segmented LANs, so or VLANs. And so that's a little tricky and probably beyond the scope of this show for setting that up, because you don't want them to talk to each other. But at the same time, and this is my problem with Steve calls this the three router solution for segregating your IoT devices. The theory is, as I was talking about last hour, the guy with the light bulbs, anything that's on the internet is potentially a gateway into your network, potentially a security flaw in your network. So what Steve suggested is you separate these IoT devices onto their own network, which can't communicate back to the network all of your stuff's on, your computers and so forth. The problem with that is, in order to use IoT devices, you need to communicate with them. So now it gets a little more complicated, because there's no point in having IoT devices you can't access. I guess if it's just an Amazon Echo or something like that, that's fine. But if you have lights or a thermostat or anything like that, you're going to want to figure out a gateway that you can talk to it. Now it gets a little bit more complicated. But I think you're on the right track exactly. pfSense is the way to go. It's open source, and it's going to be much more secure, much more up-to-date. One of the things we're really seeing is that these routers that we're all using, these kind of appliance routers, cheap routers, are really not being kept up to date by their manufacturers. They're basically abandoned in many cases, and so there's all sorts of security issues involved. I like the pfSense route. I think you're on the right track.
Okay, great. And so that's the way I've already started, but I figured I could always reconfigure it and change it if there was a better way to do it.
Yeah.
And I thought you had previously done that based on what you had said.
I did with played with a Ubiquiti Edge Router X, which is a small $59 router that lets you do that kind of VLAN segmenting. But I gave up on it for that very reason. I couldn't control things across the VLANs. And there was also some issue with about how porous the VLANs might be. If you can get across the barrier, then it's not giving you any protection at all. It's just making it less convenient. So, I am not an expert on this. I'm going to be an expert on this. We're getting somebody in to wire the house, and I'm going to have to do exactly what you're doing, which is get pfSense up and running, because I want absolute control of it. I don't want to trust some consumer router to do the job. It's one of the reasons we do recommend, like our sponsor Eero and other mesh systems. The mesh systems from most of these manufacturers, at least they're being kept up to date. They're very actively maintained, and that's a good thing. But you go out and buy a router at Staples or Best Buy, and from Linksys or Netgear, or they're basically there's security flaws in a box. So you're doing the right thing, Roger.
And then the other question is, what goes on the IoT subnet? Right now, I've got security cameras and an FTP server that they upload the video to.
Right.
And that's it. And those are accessible via an app on my phone. So they've got internet access, but they're completely isolated from the rest of the network.
Yeah, as long as that app gets to them by going out to the public internet and coming back in, that's fine. It's, that'll work just fine. It's the thermostats and things like that where you're going to have some issues. But I think you're on the right track. Security is a continuum, and there is no such thing as perfect security. It's not possible. So what you're trying to do is slide that slider a little bit more towards the secure spectrum. And remember, we talk about this stuff, but most of us aren't under attack. It's drive-by. It's, mass attacks. And in most cases, it's just not something we have to worry about, unless you're a federal agent or a spy or something like that. Nobody's going after you particularly. That by itself gives you a certain amount of security. You can protect against the mass attacks very easily. If you're a target, it's much more difficult, almost impossible. 8888, ask Leo. Great questions. 73, we'll talk soon, I hope, and stay safe. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo the phone number. Kenny, Springfield, Missouri is next. Hey, Kenny. Are you there, Kenny?
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I had a couple of questions. My first question is there any camera system that can use iCloud or Dropbox for their storage?
Wouldn't that be nice? Instead of paying, whatever it is, $5-$10 a month for storage, I think the way to go with this, if you want to save that subscription fee, is the Wyze Cams, W-Y-Z-E. They offer online service with no subscription fee. They also offer local recording. And the cameras themselves are remarkably affordable, $20 for the Wyze Cam, $30 if you want to be able to pan, tilt, and zoom remotely. So it's a really good deal.
Sounds great.
Yeah. You would pay for iCloud or Dropbox or any other storage, but with Wyze Cam, you don't pay for anything. They store it. Now, here's the negative, the one negative. It's not continuous recording. It records when it hears sound or sees motion. But that's kind of what you want. I mean, you don't want to sit there looking in an empty room for hour after hour after hour.
Right. I'd looked into Wyze Cam, and they have a micro SD card you can put in, and you can do
it. You can do continuous, yeah. So do that, and then you have the internet access for when there's motion or sound, and you get even notification on your phone.
I'll definitely get Wyze.
Great company. Yeah. It's kind of amazing because they charge for their cameras, as little as a tenth of what these other guys are charging, like Google's Nest. They don't get the monthly fees from the subscription, and they're still highly profitable, which gives you some idea how much profits build into this stuff. It's an American company, Seattle company. Of course, like everybody else, their cameras are probably made in China, but so whose aren't? But I think they're a good company with great products. They just introduced their outdoor cam, which a lot of people wanted. They sell bulbs and other stuff, too. They have home automation stuff. They have a scale now that's $20. Compare that to the Y Things smart scale, which is more like $150. They have a band, a fitness band like the Garmin, which is $25. It's kind of remarkable. I think their whole goal was to show up the entire industry and say, see, you're overcharging. There's a real opportunity for companies to do that. Anchor, with their Soundcore of headphones and other audio technology, doing somewhat of the same thing. They're saying, yeah, you know, there's a lot of markup. We can sell them for less and still make money. Georgia from San Marcos, California is next. Hi, Georgia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think I'm the last person in the world to do online banking.
Really? You haven't done it yet?
Never.
Wow. Do you actually go into the bank?
No, but I write checks.
Yeah.
And send them in the mail, you know, U.S. mail. And I'm so afraid from stories that I've heard and everything that I don't know how to do this safely.
Who do you bank with? Is it one of the bigger banks?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So they'll offer online banking that you can use.
Right.
It's completely secure. It's completely safe. Do you do any online shopping?
Oh, yes.
It's more secure than that. Because with online shopping, you're giving them a credit card number. You're making a financial transaction. Just because you're online with your bank doesn't mean the bad guys can steal anything. And here's the truth of it. Occasionally that does happen. The bank makes it good, often without telling anybody. Laws have changed now. They have to tell people. For years, though, when banks were robbed electronically online, they would just hush it up, pay back the amount, and just keep on working because they don't want anybody, especially you, Georgia, to feel like they're not safe. Over time, I think they've gotten much more safe. Your money is not at risk. It's sure a convenience. In fact, most of the time, most of the people I pay, I can pay electronically. But when I can't, I still go online to my bank and I say, write a check for me. And they will write it and mail it. So I don't have to have stamps or envelopes or even a checkbook. I have a checkbook, but I write maybe two checks a year now. And it really changes your life, I think.
So I don't have to have a separate computer dedicated to just banking?
No, you certainly don't. What kind of computer do you use?
A Mac.
Oh, you're safe. If you were using Windows, I'd say, well, you know, be careful. But on a Mac, you're safe. No, you don't have to worry about bad guys or hackers getting into your system and stealing your bank account or anything like that. Just be smart. It's the same thing you're doing anyway. You know, if you get a pop-up on your screen that says, hey, this is the bank, and, well, foreigners are using your money, so could you please log in? Don't fall for that, right? If you get text messages or emails from your bank or other bank, I get emails all the time from banks I don't even do business with saying, you know, essentially the same thing. Something scary. We see unusual transactions. Please log in. Click this link. Looks real. Except I know it's not real because I don't even do business with that bank. Just ignore those. If you do get an email from your bank saying there's been a problem, don't click the link in the email. You open up your browser and you by hand type in the address of the bank. I think it's, I understand your nervousness, but you probably did well by waiting because it has become much more secure, much more commonplace. And I think you'll really enjoy the convenience. It really is nice. I've been online banking. I started doing it with Bank of America in the 80s. It was so long ago that when you log in, you get a black screen with capital letter text only and a menu, and you'd have to hit one, and then go, and hit two, and then it was really pathetic. It's much faster now. I'm with USAA. I do all my banking online. It's much easier. I write checks. I do wire transfers. I can transfer money back and forth. I have an online broker I use for my savings accounts. And I feel very comfortable. You should feel very comfortable, Georgia. Mostly you just want to protect yourself as you would anyway by being careful about the clicks you links you click on and the sites you visit. And just don't trust it when Microsoft says, hey, it's Microsoft calling. Can we get on your computer? Say, no, go away. You can't touch it. And you're going to be just fine. I think you're going to love it.
Do you use Bill Pay?
I do, and I love it. Bill Pay is one of the best reasons to do this because I don't know about you. You sound organized. I am very disorganized, and I always forget to pay bills. Now I don't even think about it. I just have it set up. The bill goes to the bank. The bank pays it. It's automatic. And most companies, your PG&E, everybody, Southern California Edison, whatever, your power, your lights, your water, almost everybody now is an e-pay, your garbage. All the bills you pay are e-pay. And if they're not, you can even just set it up automatically to write a check.
Yeah.
So really, it's, you know, that little section of the desk you have where you have all your bill pay stuff and, you know, you have inbox and outbox and your checkbook and you just put that all away.
Okay.
You'll love it. You'll all say, right. Why didn't I do this sooner? And the good news is if you do run into a problem, almost always the bank takes responsibility and makes it good. It's their job to protect you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Enjoy.
I will.
Welcome to the modern world. Take care, Georgia. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Mama, don't take my Kodachrome. It's time for our photo guy, Chris Marquardt. He is our photo sensei at sensei.photo and joins us every week to help us get better pictures. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
You're watching, as I am, the SpaceX capsule be... it's been picked up. It's on the boat, and they're going to open the doors, the hatch, in just a few minutes and let Doug and Bob emerge after 2 months in space. I bet they'll be a little wobbly on their legs, but otherwise I think they're fine, and that's really good news. What an amazing accomplishment. Wouldn't it be fun to be a space photographer?
Oh, yeah, totally. But I think the dragon capsule on the screen is much nicer than my mug. So
we'll keep that up for a while. So what do you want to talk about today?
Photography, of course, and we talked about light, we talked about reflections, we talked about shadows, and today I want to talk about colors. And there's, you know, light and shadows, things have functions. We talked about that, and colors have functions too in photography. Color can be an attention grabber, color can guide your eye, it can set a mood. And like with reflections and shadows, I'd like to suggest a bit more of a deliberate use in color, of color in photography.
Chris has put together a little photo gallery on Flickr, and it's interesting. Some of these pictures are not what when you say color, I think big, bright, vibrant Miami beach, reds, greens popping. But these are not necessarily that colorful.
Well, the little gallery that I put together that I curated on Flickr has a lot of very powerful, colorful photos. And that comes down to some of the basic properties of color. If you've played with Lightroom and things, you probably have seen HSL, which is the three main properties of color is hue, saturation, and luminosity, right? So the hue is your color. Saturation is how strong it is. And luminosity is how bright it is. So the photos I chose have a certain slant, and that is that they are all very deliberate with their use of color. They are very, some are very subdued, so they use low saturation colors. Some are very strong, very high saturation, very bright colors. And a few things that you can think about when you take a photo is just putting aside everything else we talked about in the past, just the number of colors in the photo.
Yeah.
Is it more of a monochrome photo, just yellow in the photo, just blue, just red? Or does it have competing colors, or does it have complementing colors? So that is often photos who are reduced in the amount of colors are very clear, are very powerful, are very...
The very first picture is kind of a rosy picture of, I guess it looks like the Tokyo subway, and it's quite striking, even though the colors, yes. I guess this would be the saturation is a low, right?
That is low saturation. It's almost black and white, not quite, but it goes in that direction. The next thing I look for when I take a photo is what is the dominant color? Which of the colors in that scene get the most space in that picture? Some of those photos I chose are deliberately tinted in a specific way, but a lot of them, or most of them, are not. Most of them is what the photographer has found and taken a picture of. So the photographer chose what to take a picture of. They excluded things from the frame, so maybe there wasn't a distraction in with another color. Or some of them are deliberately with a contrasting color. So you have photos in there with the very classic contrasts, color contrasts, of red and green, or blue and yellow, teal and blue. Those are definitely interesting. They look nice. They have something very satisfying. Some of those photos are very, very, let's say, in your face, very over the top with saturation. And you can do this if you edit your photos. There's like a vibrancy slider, and if you move that to the right, you get a bit more heavy colors. But it kind of helps to put something in first to take a photo with these kind of colors. It's very hard to make those photos in post-production. So I'm always on the lookout for a reduction and the amount of colors, the number of colors. Usually most of my photos that I'm very proud of have two or three colors, and that's about
interesting.
It.
Not too many, in other words.
Not too many, because less is more tidy. It makes a more deliberate photo.
Yeah. Like this picture of yellow baseballs. It's just yellow with some red stitching, and it's very dominant.
And the red stitching, yep.
But it's good. I like it. Yeah.
So the photographer took everything else out, right? The photographer deliberately only cropped in very, very tightly to take all the rest out. Yeah. If you want to see some really interesting videography or filmography, cinematography, go watch a movie by Wes Anderson.
Oh, I love his
use of color. The way he works with color is just stunning, and he uses a lot of these principles. And that's what I want to say. I also have an exercise for everyone.
Good. Okay.
Just a little exercise to train your eye. Spend an hour or two with your camera, go outside, your garden, your back garden, somewhere safe, of course. And take a picture. Take pictures with only one or two colors. Reduce the number of colors. That's the one part of the exercise. And then after that, spend another hour and go crazy. Find the most colors that you can cram into one picture and see what that does.
Play with color. How fun. I might generalize here and say that a lot of what your exercises are about is thinking about what you're doing, being aware of what you're doing, and aware of what you're seeing. It's to train the eye to see, in effect. Because once you see, then you can capture and make a picture of it. We have an assignment. We're still working on it. Do you think we'll have a review maybe next week or the week after? We're getting close.
One of those 2 weeks.
Okay.
We'll see. We'll see how many things come on.
So you've got your color assignment. Go out and take some pictures outside.
Oh, that one, yeah. And the paper assignment on Flickr.
That's just for fun. The color one, take two different colors, or then get as many as you can, get as colorful as you can. And then if you want to participate in our monthly assignment, paper is the subject. And the way you do that is take pictures. The whole point of this, all of it, is just get out there and take some pictures. This time, illustrating the word, the idea, the concept, paper. If you find something you like, once a week you can upload your best. Got to be new. Up to the Flickr website. That's a free photo sharing site, flickr.com. I just renewed my pro membership for another 2 years. I really love Flickr. But you can do it for free as well. And then submit it to the Tech Guy group. Make sure you put the tag TG Paper on there so that we know that this is your submission for the paper assignment. TG for Tech Guy Paper. Renee Silverman, our moderator, will say, oh, thank you, and welcome you into the Tech Guy group. And do you put these pictures, like this color gallery that you put together, do you put that up anywhere? Is there anywhere we can see that?
You can link to that. You can put that in the show notes. We'll do that. A public gallery. Yes.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I always am curious about how you pick these. It looks like you were searching for colors and the word color, maybe. Yeah.
I was looking for color. I was looking for words like subdued color, for strong color, for monochromatic, for all the pretty much all the terms I used in the last 10 minutes here.
Is the Tokyo Cube, it's a little bluish. It looks like it's almost monochrome, but maybe it was just a gray day.
It could be that the photographer just in post-production pulled a bit on the sliders and made it a bit more monochrome than it was.
I like it. Really fun.
But that's okay. That's really that's permissible.
Great. Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Chris Marquardt. It's all about art. It's all about creativity. He teaches this. In fact, we'll do a photo review with you or give you classes at sensei.photo, SENSEI.photo. And, of course, he joins us every week. Get those paper pictures in. Assignment review coming up in the next couple of weeks. Thanks, Chris. Have a great week.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. We're talking high tech. Jim's on the line from Hart, Michigan. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Leo.
Thanks for hanging on.
Well, that's a problem. Everybody's having a problem with passwords.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember them.
Aren't they awful?
Difficulty.
Yep.
Well, I came up with a solution.
Okay, let's hear it.
It's quite simple. First off, what do they want? 8 characters, right?
Minimum, yeah.
Capitals, numbers, and some want special character.
Yep.
Right? So, let's take a date, January 1st of this year. Let's convert it into a code. And here's the code. 01, capital J, @ N, 2, and a capital K for the bug of the 2000, and 2-0.
All right.
See the format?
I do. Here's the problem. So does every hacker.
the thing is I agree, every hacker, but the password, the number that you would consider would be something that is not a birthday. Not a
so
wedding.
I'm going to stop you right here because it's possible to come up with all sorts of kooky ideas. But here's the deal with a password. Anything that makes it not random, in other words, easy to remember, makes it easier to break. And hackers have all sorts of techniques. And remember, they're going to use very high speed machines to try to break that password. So if you, for instance, replace zero with an O or an @, they've heard of that before. They've tried all of these things. I guarantee you they know this method that you're coming up with. It isn't a good idea because it's going to create a password that is much easier to crack. The good news is it's possible to create long, strong, completely random passwords that are almost impossible to crack. Your computer will do it for you right now. You can get a password manager, but you don't even have to. If you have a Macintosh, the keychain on the Macintosh will generate those long, strong, random passwords. It's much better to let the computer do it than to try to come up with a scheme of your own. Here's the other reason. You're trying to come up with a password that you can remember or kind of reverse engineer to get back. Oh, I use the kid's birthday, and I remember I replaced the thousands with a K, and the @ was an O, and that's not very good. If you can remember it, it's easy to break. That's a very good thing to keep in mind. If you can remember it, it's easy to break. Plus, and this is another real problem, you're going to be tempted, since you've come up with such a clever password, to use it more than one place. That's a problem too. What you want is, you don't want to set length. By the way, 8 characters is too short, probably. Use a longer number of characters. You want something that's really random, that's not memorable, and then you just want a program that will remember it for you, and that's a password manager. That's why I'm always talking about password managers, always recommending them. And I strongly encourage their use because they also encourage discourage the reuse of passwords, which is even worse. Why is that bad? Well, we all know that a lot of sites are broken into these days. We call them breaches, and there's a breach almost every day. So much so that we almost don't even report them anymore. It's not even news anymore. constant breaches. And in those breaches, your passwords are leaked, plus your email. Now, what happens when a bad guy, and you can buy these breaches online. You can buy, there's bazaars, there's markets where you can buy password troves, millions of them. So you go to the market, you buy some passwords. Now you've got an email address and a password. You even know what site it belongs to, but you don't care about that so much. By now, that site's probably changed the password, or the user has. But if there's a chance the user has reused that password, you might try using it on other sites. And that's why it's deadly to reuse passwords. Really, what you want is a password generator. There are lots of ways to do it. Now, there is one password you do have to remember with any password management program, and that's the master password that unlocks that. And that one you really want to be long and strong and random, but you also want to memorize it. And so for that one, you're not going to use it on any sites. You're just going to use it to lock your vault. For that one, if you wanted to use a formula for that, that would be okay. I wouldn't. Your formula is unfortunately pretty simple, pretty easy to guess. There are all sorts of ways of kind of generating a password. I've heard people say, "Well, what you do is you take the first name initial of the last 10 presidents, you capitalize it if it's a Republican, you lowercase it if it's a Democrat, and then in between each initial, you put the last year of their term or something like that, something that you can go through. I like to use song lyrics. So if you know a song, you take the first letter from each word in the song, something like that. Now, those are somewhat crackable, so it's important to add additional stuff. Phone numbers, zip codes. I like using my childhood phone number because the only place it still exists in the world is in my mind. Because when I was a kid, you know, mom beat that. She didn't beat me, but she really made sure I remembered that phone number, right? Because if I got lost, I could call home when I was 5 or 6. But that was many, many years ago. That phone number is long gone. Nobody knows it. And it's in my brain, burnt in. So I always... I can use that, for instance, to pad. This is a nice technique, too, to take an existing password and pad it. So maybe if you used your scheme and then added the zip code of when you were 16 or the phone number when you were a child or maybe just the last 4 digits of it, if you padded it with additional stuff, that would make it a little bit less guessable. But again, almost always, the ideal password is something generated by a computer to be completely random, a mix of upper and lowercase letters, numbers, and punctuation, and make it as long as that site will let you. I usually don't make it, if a site says your password has to be 63 or fewer characters, I won't make it 63. That's a hint to the bad guys. They're going to try 63 character passwords first, right? So I would always make it something a little bit less, 58, 61. And this is, it's a little pet peeve of mine. A lot of sites will give you password parameters. So you have to have one letter, one number. Anything that they give you, the hacker now has a smaller set to search. Right? What a hacker's trying to do is brute force those passwords by running every possible combination. Now, if it's long, it's random, that will take them millions, maybe trillions of years to do. It's not practicable. But anything that makes it less random, even rules about how long it is or what it's containing, that helps narrow down the search. You don't want to narrow down the search because the smaller the search, the easier it is, more likely it is they're going to brute force it. So I'd be very careful about any scheme that you can keep in your head for creating passwords because it gives you, it's a bad tendency. One, it's not going to give you the best password. Two, it's going to tempt you to reuse that. The good news is there's lots of password managers out there. Most operating systems have one. They've just announced, Google just announced Chrome is going to have, autofill is going to have effectively a password manager built into the browser. That's good. Use those. Let those passwords be generated. That's going to be the safest thing for you to do. I know what passwords are horrible. Everybody knows. It's a terrible solution. It's just the best one we got right now. And everybody in security is trying to find better ways. Really, all a password is to authenticate you, to say, I know who you are. you know, I am really this person, right? I'm really Jim. That's what it's all about. Add a two-factor to it, and that's going to make it even more difficult. Actually, when we come back, I'll talk about the Twitter hack. We now know how it worked. And yes, they had two-factor, but the bad guy was even smarter. Our show today brought to you by LastPass. You knew, smarty pants. LastPass. We were talking about password managers. Man, the guy had that scheme. He was going to have 0-2K, and he was going to... I just wanted to shake anybody who's trying to do their own thing and say, look, it's been solved. It's LastPass, the perfect password manager. It generates long, strong, uncrackable passwords, remembers them for you, encrypts it. They do it right, too. Your data is only decrypted on device, on every device, by the way, iOS, Android, Mac, Windows, Linux, every browser. It's the first thing I install is LastPass. It's the first because then when I install everything else, LastPass fills it in, unlocks it for me. It's great. And if you're a business and you're not using LastPass Enterprise, you're taking a big chance. LastPass surveyed global IT decision makers. 96% of them, almost everybody, said their remote workforce has impacted their identity and access management strategy. In short, they're password managers. How can you manage identities and promote good security behaviors when your employees are home? You can with LastPass. LastPass allows, of course, for, as I mentioned, secure password storage. Your employees have their vault for storing every app, every web login. By the way, I trust it so much, I even store documents like my passport, my driver's license, social security numbers. I put it all in LastPass. It's my secure enclave for everything. Employees often have to share passwords. Now, you don't want them writing it on a pad of paper and mailing it. No. Put it in a text message. No. You want them to use LastPass. It has secure built-in password sharing. Makes it easy. Employees can share logins but keep access to your company's data safe. It streamlines every login, of course. That's one of the reasons employees love it. It's one of the reasons I love it. It makes life easier. It's one of those rare things that is both more secure and more convenient. Usually it's one or the other. This is both. That's LastPass. Capture and fill every credential without disrupting your workflow. Centralized control means your IT department can enforce policies, get actionable insights into every employee password behavior right from the admin dashboard. You know if they're doing it right, if they're doing risky things. It simplifies user management. It's easy to add and remove users. You can automate it with directory integration. No matter where employees work, they have their passwords with them, but they're still secure. And LastPass's IAM solutions help businesses improve the employee experience and safeguard cyber threats. Let your remote workforce focus on their work without compromising your business security. Please, please use LastPass. Secure your remote workforce with LastPass. Just go to LastPass.com/twit. Thank you, LastPass, for making us safer at Twit, making me safer for the last 12 years I've been using it. And thank you for using that address so they know you saw it here. LastPass.com/twit. It's a no-brainer. LastPass.
They're doing great. They're feeling good. And they're pretty comfortable there inside a Crew Dragon.
So you won't believe this, Bob and Doug, but the virus is even worse than when you left.
Why are you all still wearing masks?
Well, there's a little story there. Why, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We got your smartphones. We got your smart watches. We got all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo, the number to call if you want to talk high tech with me. I'm here for you. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Let's go to Thousand Oaks. Penty is on the line from TO. Hello, yeah. Penty.
Yes, sir. I was wondering why my Acer Chromebook is freezing in a video meeting. It's just very annoying.
Yeah, so it's just little pauses, and then it picks up again?
Yes.
Yeah, that's so annoying. And you're using Zoom?
Yes.
Yeah. So it may be that the processor, a lot of Chromebooks don't have super fast processors. So maybe the processor is having a hard time keeping up. It's more likely, but it could be that, but it's more likely that the Wi-Fi, are you using Wi-Fi?
Yes.
Yeah, that the Wi-Fi radio in there is perhaps not as good. This is another way Chromebooks... What's the difference in price between that and your HP Envy?
Well, HP was $1,200, Chromebook yeah. was $250.
So there you go. In a nutshell, that's what you pay for. You get faster right. processors, better parts. There's going to be a better trackpad, better screen, better keyboard, and things like that we don't really think about, like a better network card in there. Sure. RAM is probably not an issue. Is there 4 gigs of RAM in that Chromebook?
I assume so. I haven't really checked all the tricks.
Chromebooks don't take as much memory. You know, there are things you can try to do. Of course, close down anything that's running that while you're doing your Zoom call. Besides that, don't have any other tabs open in the browser. Don't have any other applications running in the background. That might help because that takes up RAM and processor, and that could be one of the things that's slowing it down. But, you know, my guess is when you see that kind of hesitation, what that is when you see hesitation like that and it picks up again is what we call a dropped packet. So the video gets sent to you in little chunks called packets. They come if they come out of order or one of the packets doesn't come in time. What will happen is the video will stop and wait till it gets the next packet, the next frames, and then continue on. That's what it sounds like to me is dropped packets. And that can happen because your computer is busy. It can't keep up, but can also happen and is more likely, I think, to happen because the internet is not keeping up. So that's why you pay $1,250 for the Envy. You know, that's the difference.
So do you think the higher priced Chromebook would have worked
yeah.
better?
So the more expensive Chromebooks, same thing. They'll have faster processors. They'll often have more memory. Okay. If you only had 2 gigs of RAM, for instance, that could be the cause. I'm sure you have 4. Who made, you said it was Acer?
Yes.
Yeah, those are pretty good Chromebooks.
I like it otherwise.
Yeah, the price is that's the differential, right in a nutshell.
Okay, I appreciate the help. Thank you.
My pleasure. One thing you might consider, somebody in the chat room suggesting, not a bad idea, you can buy an inexpensive Wi-Fi adapter that just go on the USB port. They're not expensive, $10, $15, $20. It might actually have a better radio, and also because it's external of the Chromebook, it might get better reception. You might be less likely to have that kind of hesitation. That's pretty typical. You know, it's the equivalent kind of a buffering when you're watching a video. That freeze and then that stutter happens in real time, things like Skype calls. You've heard it before where just a little dropout video. It's much more obvious because the frame just freezes. It stops and then picks up again. Sometimes Skype, and I bet Zoom does this too, but certainly Skype will do this. If it gets behind, if there's a couple of freezes, then when you come back, you'll be talking extra fast and the video will be a little bit faster because it's catching up. It's a challenge. What's going on is really kind of impressive. It's a challenge to keep that real-time video and audio flowing if you don't have a perfect connection. Jay on the line from Temecula. You're next. Hi, Jay. Hello, Jay. Are you there, Jay? I hear you, but I don't hear you. I hear you, but I don't hear your voice. Are you muted, perhaps? No, I don't know. Maybe Jay doesn't hear me. I'll tell you what. Oh, I get it. That's because I didn't pick up Jay. I picked up Mike in Burbank. Hi, Mike. Sorry about that, Jay. We'll be with you next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Leo. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
I've got two old Acer desktops. The newer one of the old machines is working fine. I've updated both of them to Windows 10. The old machine was December of 19, and I've had no problem. Since the update, I've installed an SSD for my 2-terabyte drive and had no problem. Until recently, after I thought I needed to run Microsoft System Files Checker, I ran SFC scan mm-hmm. now a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And after that ran, I have 4 accounts on the machine. After that ran, my account had some problems. I could not get into settings.
Oh.
And so I thought, well, you know, let me do a system restore. No help with that. And so I thought, got to the point where I said, well, I think I'll do a Windows 10 repair reinstall.
Okay, that's the next step. You're right.
Okay, so I did that.
Yeah.
And it seemed to go fine. It wanted me to create a DVD, which I did, and installed from that. Fine, but I couldn't get back on the internet after that.
Ugh. What a nightmare.
I've got a real old Realtek combo card, you know, wireless and Ethernet. And I also purchased a number of years ago a D-Link, one of those balls, and it gave me 5 gigahertz. And so I bought that and used it as a USB connection.
Yep.
And I can't get either one of those working with this new version of Windows. Now, I'm curious, because both Acer machines have Windows 2.04. The newer Acer has .388, you know, 19041 .388. My old one from last couple of nights ago has 19041 .421. So it's obviously the absolute latest version of Windows 10 2004. So what I'm concerned about and what I think is going on is that this is an old machine from 2012. I bought in 13, and I have a feeling it doesn't like my Realtek, card. It's a PCIe card, and it doesn't like my D-Link ball. So I thought maybe I'd order another Ethernet-only card.
Before you do that, go into the device manager. You're sophisticated, obviously. You know about the file scanner and all that stuff. So you know that if you hit the easiest way, Windows X, and you take look at the device manager, which will be in that pop-up menu, and see if it's even seeing those devices.
It is. But I can't ping my router. I can't ping my IP address.
And you don't see an X or an exclamation mark on it?
I've seen the X come and go on the D-Link USB ball.
Okay.
I've seen it come and go. It's loaded at the drivers sometimes and sometimes not.
Because the device manager will tell you if, A, Windows sees it. Good news, it does. And, B, if you've got the right driver for it. And it sounds like you do, because if you're not getting a red X or a yellow exclamation mark in a triangle, that means everything, from Windows' point of view, is operating normally. You can go into the properties of those, and you might do that and make sure, you know, just take a look at the settings. You might turn off sleep, for instance. Sometimes on Ethernet cards, that can cause a problem. I'm not sure exactly what's going on.
I haven't seen that. Sleep as a listed item.
It is. If you go deep within the properties,
okay.
Most internet, network devices have the ability to sleep. And I always turn that off. Sometimes that can cause...
Wake on LAN thing.
Yes, yeah, that can... Well, it's wake on LAN is different. I presume you unplugged the ball and plugged it back in again.
Oh, yeah.
That's how you signal to Windows, hey, I got a new device. You get the thing-dong, and then Windows will download drivers for it. It's possible, who knows, that the new version of Windows doesn't support those two devices. I would go to the Acer site, the manufacturer's site. In fact, I always do this when I do a fresh install of Windows. In effect, that's what you've done. Go to Acer's site and get the drivers for that computer directly from Acer. And that there may be motherboard drivers. Usually the network drivers are part of the motherboard set. Get all of those because that may be where you get those. It may not be available to Windows. So plug and play, which is the normal way Windows will get a device driver. It'll say, oh, I see this new device. Let me download it. Windows may not have it available. Microsoft may not put that in the download. So generally, it's a good idea to go to the manufacturer. Not Realtek, not the ultimate manufacturer, but the company that made the computer. They integrated the whole thing together. And they'll have drivers on their site. Now, it's also going to be a clue if they don't have Windows 10 drivers on their site. That will be a hint that perhaps it isn't supported. And that's possible. It's only 7 years old. It doesn't seem like that should be a problem. But before I would go out and get a replacement, I would absolutely make sure that these two different devices don't work. And that's, you know, going to the manufacturer's site. In the case of the ball, go to the manufacturer's site. In the case of the Realtek drivers, get those from Acer. And then, yeah, if none of that works, you can take the stuff out. I presume the Realtek's on the motherboard. You can't take that out, but you can disable it. And you can buy a new one, get a new, more up-to-date Wi-Fi card. And this is so annoying. So annoying. It may also be, it's probably not worth it. It's so cheap to replace those network devices. You know, $10 to get a new Wi-Fi card. It might not be worth the trouble of erasing the drive and starting over, but that may also be something you want to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number. Jay on the line. I'm sorry to scare you, Jay. Now you're on the line for real from Temecula. Hi, Jay.
Hi, can you hear me now?
I hear you great. Yeah, sorry about that.
All right, great. By the way, listening to all that splash sound was very nostalgic.
It
was,
yeah, isn't it?
Back to my childhood.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. We grew up watching all those amazing space flights culminating and landing on the moon, and it's nice to see it back. Yeah.
It was must-see TV back then.
It really was. I remember getting up in my jammies, sitting on the couch watching the old Zenith.
Yeah, exactly. You had the conversation with Scott a couple of weeks ago or 2 weeks ago about the new ATSC 3.0
yes.
and TVs.
Yes.
And then last year you talked about dumping your TV service and going to Silicon Dust. And then you postponed it because something new was coming.
Well, they postponed it. That's the problem. The HD Home Run Prime that I wanted. They were supposed to get out late last year. They still haven't got it out, so I don't know.
Well, it says now August. I'm looking at their
good
log.
Yeah.
So you haven't done anything.
No. Yeah. So, and I'm spending, as I'm sure a lot of people are, a ridiculous amount of money for cable television. The goal would be
that's the reason I'm calling.
Right.
They dropped Stars and they dropped Epic, and then they charged me $16 more a year.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, why am I paying for all this?
Right.
So, anyway, so then I had one point a year ago, I bought I went to Best Buy and got an over-the-air TV antenna and put it up on my roof to do a proof of concept, and I could get channels from Riverside, just happened to have a trough through the valley.
Nice.
So I know I can get channels.
That's great.
The question is, what do I use as a receiver? And I was on hold to find out what you were going to do with Silicon Dust. And now there's this new unit that's better, faster, all that.
So Silicon Dust offers two different OTA, or over-the-air DVRs, the Home Run Connect Duo and Quattro. And what those Duo and Quattro means is how many tuners are in there, whether there are two or four. And the reason you want multiple tuners is so you can watch one show and record another one with two, or watch one show and record three others with four. You can decide what you want. If you've got an antenna and you're getting – my problem is I don't get over-the-air TV. We're just far enough north of San Francisco's Sutro Tower where all the you've got Mount Wilson in your area. And if you can get those over the airs, then you're in a much better position. What's been happening? For instance, I was using for a while. YouTube has YouTube TV, and it has the locals, nice, and it has a few other channels, you know, sports and news channels, nice. It makes kind of a great basic cable package. When they first came out, oh, $35, what a deal. Then it went up to $50. Oh, less of a deal. Then it went up, I think it's now $60 or $65. And I'm thinking, this is like cable all over again. And I don't know if I can if you can blame YouTube or Google, or if you're using PlayStation or a Sling. I don't know if you can blame them, because I think what's happening is the content creators are driving the prices up. The locals are demanding more money. So the best deal is going to be what you can do, which is get over the air, because that's always going to be free. It's not going to be ad free, but you're going to at least get your live locals. So if you can get an antenna up, you can get – there are a number of companies, Tableau. Amazon makes something called the Recast. There's the Silicon Dust HD Home Runs. There's one more, Midnight Commander. What is it called? I can't remember the name, but there are at least four or five over-the-air DVR companies. The big differentiator is some of them you have to pay a monthly or yearly fee for the cable guide. Some of them you don't. So that's one thing that might add to the cost that you should consider.
But all those costs are less than 1 month of my cable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Plus, there's something nice in sticking it to the man.
Yeah.
The problem is that YouTube TV is now the man. So you just flee one man for another man. It's not such a good deal. So I think you're smart. If you can get over the air, I always recommend a couple of sites. TV Fool is really, I think, the best one. You probably know about it, TVFool.com, where you enter in your location. It will tell you where to aim your antenna and what locals you can get and what quality you can expect. That's a really good starting point to say, well, is it worth doing this? You took the chance to put the antenna up. Good news. You're in a trough. Who knew?
Yeah.
So that's how many channels do you get?
It was really hard to tell because I didn't have a tuner. I just stuck it.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the next step is a tuner, and that's what all these offer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got over 100.
Oh, you're great. You're great.
Like, you know, Korean TV and Spanish TV, and a lot of things I would never watch.
Yeah, a lot of the UHF channels, forget them. You want really what you want is the main, you know, network affiliate channels, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, those low numbers. Right. But if you can get those, you can always buy over the top HBO or whatever else you want. And I think you might save money in the long run. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Thank you.
Yes, the way to go. I would look at, so every time I talk about this, somebody says, well, you didn't mention. So there seems to be more and more of these. The Amazon Recast is a fairly inexpensive one that I have not tried. And I don't think that one has a monthly fee. So that's the Fire TV Recast, and that uses over the air. You need an antenna, obviously, which you already have. There's Tableau.
No, I took it back.
You took it back. Well, you know you can get it now.
I know.
You know you can get it. In fact, before you buy another antenna, go to antennaweb.com and see what kind of antenna. TV Fool will tell you what you'll need, you know, how directional and all that stuff. Tableau is another one. It's an OTA DVR. And then there's the HD Home Run. The one I was looking at was actually uses cable card. That's what I'm waiting for, but then I would keep the cable. So that's...
Yeah, Silicon Dust has that as one of their options.
Yeah,
six.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one that's not out yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, TechHive rated Tableau is their favorite. Then the Recast. Plex. I should have mentioned Plex also does this. That was what I was going to do: is combine Plex with the HD Home Run Prime. And then I would have
technology server.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of it. Then you have it in, it's on the whole network. So anything that's connected to the network can become a TV and watch whatever you've DVR'd in that centralized DVR. That was my goal. Tableau does want a fee, I guess. PlexPass is cheap. It's antennaweb.org. Thank you, ScooterX, not .com. AntennaWeb.org and TVFool.com are the two sites to figure out what you can get where you are and what kind of antenna you would need. And then, yes, you'll need a tuner, and if you want DVR, you'll need something with, you know, hard drive and DVR functionality.
Yeah. The one of the things, for instance, reading this, talking about this new device that handles 3.0, it talks about high-resolution 1080p and 4K content.
Right.
I know about having the conversation. I don't have a... You know, I'm not going to be able to handle the high speed, you know, I guess it's the 3.0. I don't have a TV for that, but I don't care. I'm trying to future proof.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, TV stations are going to ATSC 3. Whether they'll go to 4K is another matter entirely, right? They don't have to do 4K. And since they spent a lot of money getting to 1080p, I think the LA stations will probably go to 4K before a lot of other stations will.
Is the over-the-air signal high definition at least?
Yes. It's
okay.
HD everywhere. And ATSC does allow 4K if the stations choose to do it. ATSC is going to be a mixed bag. You know, it's one of those things. Whether broadcast will jump on it or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, but it's be prudent.
Right now, if I'm going to buy one and I can get that as an option for roughly the same money.
Then you should get it.
Right.
On the other hand, that's just the tuner component. So it won't be that expensive to upgrade in a couple of years should ATSC 3.0 comes along. I wouldn't say that that's a deal breaker, not having ATSC 3.
No. Yeah. Okay.
Well, have fun. It's a good project. It'll make you feel good.
if it works.
If it works, it'll make you feel good. Yeah. No, I was foolishly waiting for this HD Home Run Prime. I don't know when they're going to come out with that. I have a feeling that's what we call in the business vaporware, non-existent. We'll see. Thanks for the call. Oh, yeah, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. Professor Laura making a little political statement there. I like it. Thank you, Professor Laura. We were talking with Jay earlier about over-the-air TV, and, man, it's just a mess right now. It's just a mess. I thought the transition would happen by now. We'd all be watching our TV on the internet. Who cares about over-the-air? Who cares about cable? Just give me fast internet. And in fact, the cable companies are suffering. Comcast subscriptions way down this year. I think they lost 477,000 subscribers. But see, Comcast knew this was coming. All the cable companies knew this was coming. So what did they do? Well, they just slowly raised the prices on their internet. That's what they did. Because they knew eventually you would be moving away from buying the premium service. And so they said, well, we'll just make it up in 477,000 customers. That was just Q2, 12% drop in revenue. But while they lost a lot of TV customers, they gained a ton of internet customers. So there, they got you. They got you one way or the other. They aren't making quite as much money. Not that I feel bad about that. And the thing is, every time I talk about this, I get emails from people saying, well, this is definitely going to save you money. There are ways to watch free TV over the internet or less expensive TV. There's even ad-supported free services. But the stuff that I want to watch anyway, and I bet most of you want to watch, that's getting more and more expensive, even if it's over the internet. So you add the a la carte, just get the channels I want or the services I want, plus the internet, plus the hardware, and I think you come pretty close to cable. Honestly, I don't think you save a lot of money. You might feel better, but I don't think, you get Pluto TV. Things I don't really want to watch Brady Bunch reruns with commercials. That's not what I'm looking for. And the good stuff's going to cost you. 323,000 broadband customers gained when they lost 477,000 television customers. That tells you. And that doesn't even count the 600,000 folks, low-income folks receiving free Internet Essentials service from Comcast. Big jump. That's not surprising. We're all quarantined. We want Zoom. We want to be able to, use the internet more and more. It's not surprising. But money's tight. So what are you going to spend money on? Internet, not TV, right? 8888-ASK-LEO. Gary on the line from Buffalo, New York. Hello, Gary.
Hey, Leo. Listening to a call yesterday about MNVOs for Verizon. The one I use is Red Pocket. The only reason I use it is none of the other ones said my phone would work. Even though my phone works on, I've got the Motos. They work on all the carriers.
Yeah, Verizon and Sprint are the outliers. They're the weird. They used to do CDMA, and now I think their antennas, their frequencies are a little oddball. That's the weird thing. You have to choose a phone that works with the frequencies. Now, what's interesting is Red Pocket is on Verizon.
Oh yeah, my phone is on the Verizon network on Red Pocket.
So that's so weird.
Would work if I. If I go to Verizon, these phones work on Verizon.
Oh, they do work on Verizon, but just not on.
Won't work on Visible. Won't work on Spectrum.
That's so strange. Because Visible's also Verizon. Yeah.
Yeah, it won't work on Yahoo. It says no.
Really?
I was wondering. Yeah, is there some software? Because Spectrum was telling me that the phone had to be designed to work on their system. Is there some software they're using on those ones that it won't?
No. That it's frequencies. It's radio frequencies. So when you get a phone, and you're getting cell service and you're getting data. You're getting those over radios, obviously, right? And they're on different frequencies. And it's my guess, I don't know for a fact, but Verizon has a number of different frequencies for data. And it sounds like they're dedicating certain frequencies to Visible and Yahoo. They're not doing the same for Red Pocket, which I think is the least expensive of their MVNOs. They're not even an MVNO. I think they're owned, aren't they? Or maybe not.
I don't know. No,
I can't remember.
I had the choice of the problem is I use T-Mobile on my regular phones, but I needed a phone for when I'm out hiking and biking because I'm in rural areas where T-Mobile doesn't do well. So I was looking for a cheap plan for that, and I couldn't get one, and then I found Red Pocket, and they did it. And this is a phone that was on Verizon at one point.
Right.
You know, it's an unlocked
phone. Frequencies. And so your phone has a number of different radios, and I think what they're telling – so there's nothing software can do to fix that. That is built into the phone. And in fact, when you buy phones, nobody does this because most of the time you buy the phone from the carrier you're going to use. But if you were buying unlocked phones, which I usually do, I always look at what frequencies, because you can buy a phone, for instance, that's available in the Middle East or Asia or Europe that won't even work in the U.S. or will only use limited numbers of frequencies, maybe slower frequencies. So it's my guess that the phone you have is designed to use specific frequencies, not the ones that Visible and Yahoo Mobile are using. But good news, Red Pocket does use those frequencies.
Yeah, and it's the least expensive of them all.
Yeah. So you worked out. I don't think there's any software that you can change because it's in the hardware. It's just the radios. It's the antennas. It's the way it's built.
Yeah, these were the Moto G and X phones, direct from.
Yeah, great phones. But you got them from Verizon. So they were.
Oh, no, I bought it direct from Motorola.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, okay. I bought these direct from Motorola.
I usually go to a site.
T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon. I've used them on all different.
I usually go to a, if you want to track this down, I usually go to a site called GSM Arena, gsmarena.com. They will give you the specs for the model you have and what, in particular, what frequencies that model supports. And so it'd be.
Quick question.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, no, that's all. That's all I had to say.
The Google's going to announce, release, whatever. When are they going to start selling?
My best guess is tomorrow.
Will they start selling it when they announce it, you think?
Yeah.
They're going to announce it. It's going to be available in October.
We're talking about the Pixel 4a, which is going to be a low cost. In fact, we've started to see leaks of the prices, really low cost. I think $330, something like that, version of their Pixel 4 flagship phone. The 3a, the previous low-cost version of the 3, it was very popular. I expect the 4a to be very popular. Would normally have come out in May during Google I.O. Google canceled that because of COVID and has been just so, you know, delaying this phone. I don't have any inside information. My guess, though, is they've been stocking up, and the reason they're going to finally announce this is they've got enough, they can sell them. So tomorrow morning, bright and early, get up, go to store.google.com and see if they've announced it.
Is it something they do at midnight or is it something they do at 9 a.m.?
No. I don't have any inside knowledge.
Whenever they feel like it?
I would say, whenever they feel like it. Exactly. Whenever they feel like it. But they have taken, I think they took the 3A off sale. I think now is the rumor is pretty strong that it will be tomorrow or Tuesday. And that's going to be a nice phone. That's going to be a very nice phone.
I think I'm going to replace one of my Motos with one.
Yeah, I would say it'll be the reason you got those Motos is inexpensive but good quality and kind of pure Android. Well, there's no pure Android than the Google phone. And the rumor on the Pixel 4a is the price is going to be really low. So it'll be very attractive. I think that, you know, they kind of got stuck. I don't know whether it was the factories couldn't crank them out or they couldn't get into the stores, but $349 is the price for 128 gigs of RAM and of storage and 6 gigs of RAM. It looks pretty nice. Camera won't be, you know, as probably they did with the 3, as they'll probably do again, which would be a single camera, not the three lenses they do on the, or the two lenses they do on the Pixel 4, but I think it'll be the phone to get if you want to get a low-priced phone. There's some really good choices out there. And, of course, Samsung's big announcements this week, too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Can it be? Has it come to that? We're almost out of time. last segment of the weekend. Thank you so much for coming and listening to the show and letting me be myself. Thank you to Lady Laura, Professor Laura. I've promoted her. She's Professor Longhair with her baton, our musical director, telling the bands to play and stop playing and all that stuff. She's got her hands on the faders, her fingers on the pulse of this program. Thanks also to Kim Schaffer, our phone angel. Without her, would you be able to get on the air and ask your question? I think not. And, of course, thanks mostly to all of you who listen. Let me do my thing every weekend right here. We'll be back next weekend answering calls, answering your questions, helping you get the most out of technology. I hope you will, too. Let's go to West L.A. Bart's on the line. Hi, Bart.
Hello.
Hello.
A question about Sea Cleaner. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. And there was just good a big bad warning against using Sea Cleaner.
No.
Yes.
From who?
Well, it's not okay. So let's talk about Sea Cleaner. First of all, Sea Cleaner is a tool that's been around forever from Piriform, and the idea is it cleans up your PC, mostly cleans up your PC by cleaning up your registry, but it can get rid of temp files and things like that. It's for optimizing. Microsoft Defender, which is the antivirus on all Windows 10 computers, is flagging Sea Cleaner as potentially unwanted software. But there's a little asterisk I should put on this. The reason is frequently when people get Sea Cleaner, they also get other things with it that are part of the download, things like the Google browser toolbar and the Avast antivisor, neither of which I recommend. So these aren't from Piriform. They're not from the Sea Cleaner folks. But because Sea Cleaner comes often with installers and other software, Microsoft has decided to kind of say this is what they call a PUA, which is a potentially unwanted app. Those are the things that come along with it. Now, I've always said you don't need Sea Cleaner. It can't do anything really useful, because if it did, the risks would be too high. Have you ever edited your registry? Don't.
No.
Don't. Because, yeah, sometimes you do need to. You want to. Maybe there's things in your registry. Sometimes people are really kind of extra sensitive to messes, and they don't want leftover bits of old programs in their Windows registry. And I understand that. But it's very risky to go in and modify the registry, partly because any changes to the registry are instant. You can make your machine unbootable easily in the registry just by a registry edit. So you shouldn't, unless you really know what you're doing, you shouldn't do it. Sea Cleaner will do it, but in order to protect you, they're very cautious. They really don't do anything valuable. If they did, there would be a high risk of accidentally doing something dangerous or problematic. So I don't think I don't recommend it. It's an extra expense, an extra complexity you don't need. And certainly you should be careful if I don't know where you would get it, that it would have this other stuff. This is Sea Cleaner's response. This was just in the news. It's funny that you should call, because this was in the news yesterday. Sea Cleaner spokesperson told Tech Radar, "We're in the process of engaging with Microsoft to understand why Sea Cleaner was recently detected as a PUA. We surmise this issue appears to be around bundling, and we've addressed this so our product is no longer flagged." But that's, in a way, a bad sign. If Piriform was bundling in other stuff like the Avast antivirus and the Chrome toolbar and even the Chrome browser, they made some money on that. I don't like that. I just want, you know, I think that that's, I don't want those things. So I understand why Microsoft flagged them. It's not that
there's a freeware version of it.
That's where you're going to get all that crap.
Okay, there's a $20 version you can upgrade to.
Right.
Is that better?
No, it's the same. It probably doesn't have all that extra stuff. I don't think it does anything you need. Why do you want it?
just to clean out, you know, all the crap that builds up over time. And,
yeah.
you know, I go in and clean out my history download anyway.
Right.
Am I doing the same thing that CCleaner is doing?
No, because CCleaner mostly, when it first came out, it was all about registry editing. I think now they're doing other temp files. I wouldn't worry about it. Windows does a pretty good job of cleaning that up. If Windows didn't do a good job, I'd say, yeah, you need it. And certainly in the old days, you did need a lot of third-party utilities if you were running Windows. But it's not the same today. If you're running, are you running Windows 10?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it.
By the way, my other question would be, because I had to download the latest patch they gave me for Windows 10. What happened to buying a cheap desktop anymore? Fry's doesn't even carry them. Or I think they're having some kind of battle with China. And so they don't even stock desktop computers anymore. It's the strangest thing.
Yeah.
Where do I get a cheap computer? And I don't want a refurb. I don't want a computer.
What is cheap to you?
$300 to $400. I don't game, so, you know, I just use it for word processing. That's it.
Well, I would say, I mean, the resellers are dying out. Fry's is struggling a little bit. That's part of it. I think the resellers are dying out. Whatever happened to CompUSA, right? Or the good guys. And so I think nowadays when you buy a computer, more often than not, you're buying it directly from the manufacturer. And certainly Acer, A-C-E-R, offers low-cost computers in that price range. Asus, Dell even does. I think you can get a decent computer for under $500. You're going to make some sacrifices, but yeah, I think you can.
Refurbs are bad.
Refurb only from the original manufacturer, never from a third party. So I would, for instance, never buy a refurb at Fry's. When you're buying a refurb from the original manufacturer, a Dell, a Lenovo, an Apple, almost always what that was is a computer that was purchased and then returned instantly. Somebody opened the box and said, I don't like it, or I can't afford it, and sent it back. They're not allowed to resell that as new. It's open box, but it's hardly used. That's fine. And the companies that make them check them and certify them and give you the same warranty you would get if you bought it new. That's fine. I wouldn't do it from a third party.
Okay.
Unless they really – unless
I have
you
an
trust
Acer. It's like – my Acer is 6-7 years old, and it's fine. But
yeah.
Every time I do the 10 update, my computer freaks and I lose things.
Well – I hate Windows.
Okay.
That's all I can say. I hate Windows. I would look at a Chromebook. If you really want an inexpensive computer that's for surfing the net, checking your email, buying things online, it's more secure, more robust, less expensive, look at a Chromebook.
You got it.
Windows is more complicated than you need, probably. You know, 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, when most of us first became aware of personal computing, you didn't have the choice. You know, you had to buy a Mac or a PC. That was it. But both Macintosh operating systems and the Windows operating system are general purpose operating systems. They're designed so that you can run any of thousands of programs. They're wide open. They were designed in an era where security was not as much of a concern. They're much more complicated than they need to be, and they're getting old. They're long in the tooth. Especially Windows, is really showing its age. It's creaky. And the reason you know it's creaky is because every time Microsoft puts out an update, it breaks something. That means it's held together with chewing gum. It's just way overcomplicated. And the truth is, what people mostly do with computers nowadays, they don't need a general-purpose computer. You don't need to install any of those hundreds of thousands of other programs. You need a browser. You get your email. Look at what you do. If you're designing rocket ships, if you're editing movies, if you're, there are a few things where, you know, solving differential calculus, there are a few things where you need a more powerful computer. For the most part, what everybody does is done just fine by an iPad or a Chromebook. And they're much more secure and much more reliable. So that's how I would go. And less expensive, by the way. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.